Okay, just a very brief introduction for Dr. Mirsky, who I go back to our days with in Yeshiva University, where he used to write these, you know, beautiful articles in the student newspaper, which I couldn't understand every word of them. The philosophical articles, and it's always been a very deep thinker. He, after he graduated YU, he's had a very interesting career, but from an academic point of view, he graduated Yale Law School, just got a PhD not that long ago at Harvard, and in Jewish studies, and his book on Rav Kook is coming out by Yale University Press in February. He worked at the State Department in the Human Rights, Commission, I don't know the exact language, and he worked for Al Gore. He was the research person doing on his book, and he's been a speechwriter. He's worked for many people in politics. He made Aliyah over 10 years ago, and now he's on for 3 years. He'll be teaching at Brandeis. He's in the middle of his second year. So since he's only in Boston, so it's a short hop away, so it's a pleasure to have him for the weekend over Shabbos, and he'll speak on Rav Amital, who everybody here knows is a very important person in the religious Zionist world and the development of the State of Israel. Without further ado, Dr. Mirsky.
Thanks so much. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Mani Agid, you know. And for me to talk about Rav Amital, Zichrono Livracha, it was always a great privilege. And I grab every chance I can get to talk about this this extraordinary man who's worth knowing about. I mean, one of the things, and this is just to get right into it, a key point about Rav Amital, and it's not only about him. I mean, all religious virtuosi, right? The great religious figures who really shape and reshape their traditions, and whose life and whose teachings, whose lives are their own teachings, and, they tend to have this. One of my little crackpot theories about things, they tend to have something in common, is that a unique, very personal, not easily replicable, or maybe not meant to be replicated, combination of great faithfulness and great daring. Great, deep faithfulness and commitment to traditions, and great audacity in how they go about being faithful. Now, in the case of Rav Amital, one complicating matter for talking about his legacy is that he didn't write very much. You know, earlier my two other talks here, courtesy to my old friend Jay Kelman, it's just a pleasure to see him, as well as to be reunited with Yitz Kuritz after too many years, and David Fishman and David Freudenstein. It's just wonderful to see people who I who have such a place in my heart, and I get to see nearly as often as I'd like. So the person that I spoke about earlier today, twice, Rav Kook, the issue with him is that he wrote too much. It's that he's writing and writing and writing and writing and writing, and just how do you reconcile, and he's changing his mind all the time. And a friend of mine who, like me, works in the field of Rav Kook studies, said, you know, usually every, you know, and also in recent years, we've been blessed with the fact that a number of manuscripts hitherto on some hitherto unknown works of Rav Kook, or works that had been published only in fragmentary form. Now we have the complete manuscripts of so many books of his, works of his, and there's still more to be rediscovered. Just keep getting published. And a friend of mine said, you know, usually with most thinkers, every time one of their unpublished manuscripts sees the light, you feel you understand them better. And he said, but with this fellow Rav Kook, you know, the more he writes, just the mystery only deepens. Who was he? What did he think? What did he? And part of the story we're going to get to with Rav Amital is also the question of how one interprets Rav Kook's legacy. Rav Amital is the other thing, the other direction. Rav Amital wrote very little. He wrote very little. In some ways, it's tragic how little he wrote. I mean, he wrote more than people think. And there are, you know, there are many hundreds of pages of articles, lots of transcribed sichot. One book of halachic writings that's come out, another is in the works. Several small books from which I'll be quoting, and some of you may have seen just a few months ago, a book of his sichot for Yamim Noraim was published under the title Eid Ratzon, and the editors tell me, you know, there's more to come. But still, he didn't write that much. And it's more than an incidental point. One time, a bunch of years ago, there was a certain important figure in the Musar movement who I was interested in, and there was a book of his, and it was a book that had been out of print for a while, and it took me a while till I could find it, and then I found it, and I read it. You know, Katoti, it's not my place to give out grades. Certainly, I mean, I hardly feel it's my place to give out grades in university, and certainly not my place to grade the works of Gedolei Yisrael. But still, the book didn't move me all that much, and I didn't see what the big deal was about this Gadol of the Musar movement. So the next time I went to see Rav Amital, I mentioned this to him, that I was a little, you know, I was talking about what I was learning, what I was doing. And I said I was a little perplexed, you know, there was a Sefer by so-and-so, which of course he knew about. And I said, you know, I found it, I read it, and I didn't see what the big deal was. And Rav Amital said to me, Teidalacha, Yesh ka'ile shahatorah shalahem basfarim shalahem, Yesh ka'ile shahatorah shalahem b'chayim shalahem. There are those whose Torah is in their books, and there are those whose Torah is in their lives. And I understood that in a certain sense he was also talking about himself. Right, that his teaching was the life. And also it's very key to understanding the man, because as we'll see, the teachings themselves are very bound up with life and living and how you live your life and how you embrace your life. Also, Rav Amital is not easily understood or summarized, not only because he didn't write a whole lot, but also because he was a complex man. He was a complex man who affirmed complexity while maintaining a great core of simplicity. And another thing about these great spiritual virtuosi is that they're not readily understood. Maybe they're not meant to be readily understood. And this combination of complexity and simplicity is a thread that runs through his life, and it's not something I purport to understand or to be able to explain, but it's something perhaps whose narrative arc we could trace. So, Rav Amital was born in 1924 in Transylvania, in a town called Gross Verdine, in Yiddish, or Adea. Hungarian and the Hungarian landscape of his childhood and youth was very important to him all the way through. Like much of Hungarian Jewish life, and again, Hungarian Jewish life is something that deserves to be better known and better understood than it is, because it was more complex than we usually think. But leaving that aside for a moment, his town, though, reflected the complexity of Hungarian Jewish life. It was home to Hasidim, to acculturated and assimilated Jews, to Jewish Hungarian nationalists, and even a fairly large concentration of religious Zionists. One figure from that landscape to whom Rav Amital referred to a lot was Rav Moshe Shmuel Glasner, known as the Dor Revi'i, because he was the great-grandson of the Chatam Sofer. And Rav Glasner was he died shortly before Rav Amital was born, but over the years Rav Amital increasingly kept referring back to this figure who had been kind of a rabbinic culture hero in the milieu of his youth and who had been the teacher of his of teachers of his. And in particular, Rav Glasner, who was a great Talmid Chacham, very classic Talmid Chacham, in his book, Dor Revi'i, on Masechet Chulin, he laid out a theory of an understanding of Torah Shebaal Peh that then served very much as a model for Rav Amital later on, the need for rabbinic emphasizing, the need for rabbis to exercise their own judgment and their own discretion, to a strong affirmation of the notion that there is such a thing as fundamental human ethical, moral, and impulses that don't need to be prohibitively spelled out in the Torah because they're so constitutive of our very understanding of what it is to be a human being created in God's image. As in his learning, Rav Glasner mixed the classic Brisker method with more traditional learning, and also made use of the Brisker method without the Brisker method's elaborate and specialized terminology. He was an early supporter of religious Zionism, which many rabbis were not, and for a rarity, unlike most religious supporters of religious Zionism, though like Rav Kook, actually thought that Zionism could be a vehicle not just of Jewish political and socioeconomic rescue, but even of religious and spiritual renewal and revival, which was a rare position among early 20th century religious Zionists. Now, Rav Amital, as I said, grew up in Hungary and went through rudimentary schooling. His father was a bookkeeper. He was not from a rabbinic family. His father was a bookkeeper, and he was essentially planning on following in his father's footsteps. But in May 1944, he was taken away to a Nazi labor camp, and his family was eventually deported to Auschwitz, where they were all killed. In his adolescence, he had discovered Rav Kook's writings, and even managed to smuggle a little anthology of Rav Kook into the labor camp with him. Towards the end of 1944, he was liberated by the Russians, and he headed for the land of Israel, where his grandparents lived. They had moved to Israel before the war. And he found a place learning in Yeshivat Hebron, a leading Haredi institution. The story was that the Rosh Yeshiva once asked him how it was that somebody who had come straight from the jaws of the Holocaust was able to learn with such, to learn with such fervor and such hasmada and have such yiras shamayim. And the Rosh Yeshiva asked him, how could this be? What this was, and the stories of Rav Amital said, "Tu mipnei shayali Rav Kook bayad." And the Rosh Yeshiva took that, of course, as a great insult and stopped talking to him. Nonetheless, he, though he was a penniless orphan from an undistinguished family with no yichus at all, by dint of his piety and learning, he was shidduched into one of the most distinguished rabbinic families of the time. He married Miriam Meltzer, the granddaughter of Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, who was a great Lithuanian gadol who had come to Yerushalayim in the interwar period, was a figure in Mortzeh Gedolei HaTorah. The day after Israel declared its independence, in May of 1948, Rav Amital enlisted. It was a Shabbos, right? Remember the State of Israel, the Declaration of Independence was Friday night. The next morning, he went out to enlist. And of course, some people raised eyebrows, can't it wait till Sunday? and he asserted, no, like this is something we're not, this is our new reality. This is the new lechatchila reality in which we have to live. He served in the Haganah, and wrote while he was in the army. He and the other religious soldiers with whom he served put together a shul, and they put together a journal, and in it he published what was probably the first programmatic essay that anyone wrote on what does it mean to be a Jewish soldier in a Jewish army. And both discussing halachic issues and also using Jewish law and tradition as a way, as a resource in figuring out the moral and ethical issues involved in warfare. And so at one point he writes in this essay, recognition of the value of the individual within the military is in great danger if the erroneous notion that each soldier is only a number and therefore expendable has taken root. And the essay talks about the notion of the Tzelem Elohim within each soldier. And he also, and he and his, there's a, in the Israeli assumption of responsibility for all of society, which he characterized in this essay, and he was just a young man, as the move from a narrowly defined religion to the fullness of Torah, he saw the restoration of the primal force of biblical religion, and the essay closes with Yoshua's call to the people, make yourselves holy, for tomorrow God will work with you wonders. He and other soldiers, when the army said, guess what, we can set up a separate kosher dining room for you, a separate kosher mess tent for you with the other soldiers, he said, no, we're going to eat with everyone else. No, and even if we can't eat what everyone else is eating, we're going to eat with everyone else. So you see, he's staking out, in his mid-twenties, this very interesting mix where he's not going to give up on religion and his halakha commitments while participating in the project of being an Israeli soldier and trying to bring these worlds into dialogue and while articulating some sort of principled moral spiritual stance. Rav Yitzchak Zalman Meltzer, when he read Rav Amital's essay, reportedly started crying and said, until now, we had, you know, Shulchan Aruch Or HaChaim for daily life, and we have the Rambam, Hilchot Melachim, for Yemot HaMashiach, and now Yudel has written Hilchot Melachim for Or HaChaim. In the 1950s, by the way, shortly after, Rav Amital Hebraized his name. He wasn't born Amital, he was born Klein. But he Hebraized it after the Pasuk in Micha, you know, Vaya Shirit Yaakov Be'amim Ketal Me'et Hashem, hence the name Amital, Kirvivim Aleyesev. Through the 1950s, he taught in Rehovot at the yeshiva of his father-in-law, Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Meltzer. And he developed rich network of connections with all kinds of people in the religious Zionist world and began to stake out his own vision as an educator. One marvelous story, there was a father who the yeshiva took Sephardi students as well as Ashkenazim. There's a story that a father came to him and said he was uncomfortable, an Ashkenazi father came to him and said he was uncomfortable with his son being made to learn with these, you know, Frankim. And he said to Rav Amital, I guess maybe this is what you have to do, b'dieved, you need students, you know, so you get them from wherever you can. And Rav Amital said to him, no, you don't understand. It's li'ein b'dieved. He said, achrei ha-shoah, ein b'dieved. Achrei ha-shoah, hakol lechatchila. After the Holocaust, everything is a matter of principle. And everything is a matter of not, okay, this is the best I can do. No, after the Holocaust, there is no, well, this is the best we can do. You do things because you believe in them. and you try to actualize the things in which you believe. And he also said to this father, by the way, there will be a day when you will brag that your son learned with these students whom you so casually denigrate today. And indeed, one of Rabbi Amital's students in those years was Rabbi Bakshi Doron, who eventually became the Rishon LeZion. And another is Professor Moshe Bar Asher, who is the president of HaAkademia LeLashon HaYivrit, sort of the official custodian of the Hebrew language. During the 1956 Sinai campaign, Rabbi Amital saw that his students were too impatient to sit in yeshiva, that they couldn't sit still. They were all on shpilkas. They couldn't sit still and learn. And he said to his father-in-law, "Shema, anachnu tzrichim lehagi al ezeshu hezder imatzava. We have to work out some arrangement with the army." And he was working on it, and there were some other people in the world of Tzinut HaDatid who had similar ideas. And this really was in 1959. He inaugurated, it was one of the people who inaugurated the system of yeshivot hezder, right, which had dramatically transformed religious Zionism, had huge impact on Israeli society. In sort of the early mid 1960s, he moves to Yerushalayim. Not really sure what he's going to do next. Just wanted to get out of Rehovot. Teaches a little here, teaches a little there. Teaches in one of the yeshivot created by Rav Ovadia, Ovadia Yosef, with whom he had very warm relations. After 1967, he is asked to head the new yeshiva that's being created in Gush Etzion. Right? You're familiar with this? I mean, everyone here is familiar with the story of Gush Etzion, right? Sort of Gush Etzion, this, the Etzion block, these religious kibbutzim, which were kind of the jewel in the crown of religious Zionist settlement before 1948. Sort of several religious kibbutzim and one secular kibbutz on the strategically important road between Beit Lechem and Hebron in 1948, the scene of very fierce battles. Most of the inhabitants are killed. Others are taken into captivity in Jordan. The children of the kibbutzim are sent out before. And the families of Gush Etzion had managed to maintain their own identity in the 19 years between 1948 and 1967. And so shortly after 1967, they decide to go and rebuild, including creating a yeshiva. And Rav Amital is asked to head it, and he agrees. With that, essentially, you know, Yeshivat Har Etzion, in large part, in part because of just where it was and how it was established and when it was established, in part because of who led it, becomes the flagship institution of religious Zionism. Rav Amital becomes a major figure in religious Zionism in Tzinut HaDatit. Now, from early on, he starts living a very interesting kind of educational philosophy. He decides to continue living in Yerushalayim, in the Givat Mordechai neighborhood. They send a letter to the students, telling them what Sfarim to bring, and when they're supposed to show up. And he'll show up a few days later. So when people ask, you know, it's a little counterintuitive, you know, what gives? Like, how come you're not there on opening day? And he said, because the yeshiva isn't mine, the yeshiva is the students. Early on, you know, and there's all kinds of stories from the early years of the yeshiva. One, that, you know, there was a fellow who was a gentleman of means, lived in Jerusalem, who heard that people had told him that there was this interesting yeshiva getting going in Gush Etzion, and that the Rosh Yeshiva was this really interesting man, and then he had named Rav Amital, and he ought to go and find him. So the fellow actually drove out to the Gush one day, and he walks into the yeshiva, and he's looking for the Rosh Yeshiva, looks at him, he doesn't find, and so he sees somebody mopping the floor, and he asks the guy, "Excuse me, you know, where can I find Rav Amital?" And the guy mopping the floor says, "Well, I'm Rav Amital." Early on, also, he says, as Rav Amital said, very famous reminiscence of his, when the first group of students came to the yeshiva, they asked me, what's special about this yeshiva? I told them the Hasidic story about the Baal HaTanya, who was sitting and studying in the inner room of the house. His grandson, the Tzemach Tzedek, sat in the middle room. In the outer room, there was a baby in a cradle. The baby suddenly woke from his sleep and began to cry. The Tzemach Tzedek was so immersed in his study that he did not hear the baby crying, but the Baal HaTanya, whose room was further away, did hear. He stopped learning and emerged from the room to calm the baby. On his way back, he passed the room where the Tzemach Tzedek sat and told him, when a person studies Torah and does not hear a cry for help, that's also a bitul Torah. In an interview years later, Rav Amital elaborated, every generation has its own cry, sometimes open, sometimes hidden. Sometimes the baby himself doesn't know that he's crying. And so we have to try to be attentive to the hidden cries as well. So he tries to create a yeshiva, on the one hand, where there's primacy of Limud Torah in the classic sense, and one in which he's also going to cultivate great moral and ethical sensitivity among the students, and constantly urging them to take responsibility for their own lives. Now, after a few years, he does something which is just an extraordinary, it's still, after decades on, a mind-boggling gesture, is that he turns to someone who he hardly knows, sensing that the yeshiva needs something more or a different kind of scholarship than the one he provides. He turns to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, American, in Yeshiva University, son-in-law of Rav Soloveitchik, holder of a doctorate in English literature from Harvard, an extraordinary Talmid Chacham, 8 years younger than him, and offers him, to him, to be the Rosh Yeshiva, and Rav Amital would stick around as Mashgiach. And Rav Lichtenstein eventually responds to him and says, I'm willing to come, but only on condition that you stay as Rosh Yeshiva too. And so we have two Rosh Yeshiva. So this is all extraordinary. This is a man who has his own institution, turning to somebody younger than him, who he hardly knows, who's very different from him, and saying, here, come, you be the head of this, and I'll be under you. And then the other fellow, I teach in university. I see what people do to get a tenure track job handed to them, right? And the other fellow, instead of him saying, oh, gee, great, thanks, this will be great, don't worry, says, no, I'll do this, but only if you stay with me. And this is unprecedented. And she will have two Rosh Yeshiva. And over the years, and also we're talking about an extraordinary study in contrasts. For those of you who know them, Lichtenstein, sort of tall, reserved, austere, almost Jesuitical sort of intellectual, speaks in extremely, long and elegantly formulated paragraphs and dripping with allusions to the classics of Western literature and philosophy. Very elaborate shiurim, with elaborate conceptual latticework and projecting a very deep kind of asceticism. And Rav Amital, whose halachic expertise was actually Shutim, the world of Sheilot U'Tshuvot, reportedly knew hundreds and hundreds by heart, so he loves the lived reality of halacha. Short, compact, no doctorate from Harvard, not even a high school diploma, his formal education stops with fourth grade, speaks mainly in Hasidic aphorisms, unapologetically enjoys fine whiskey and a good cigar. And the two of them work together harmoniously for decades. It's just really an extraordinary, extraordinary thing. So then we have the And also another thing that Rav Amital does, speaking of Hasidic aphorisms, is from early on, he senses that the world of religious Zionist yeshivot is getting a little dry. And he starts introducing Hasidic style elements. He's not a Rebbe, he doesn't hold himself out as a Rebbe, he doesn't hold out. But, you know, has things, tishes, vorts, a lot of singing, alongside very serious learning. Now, then comes the 1973 war, which, perhaps the single most traumatic event in Israel's history. Indeed, much of what goes on in Israeli society today is still part of the response, the reverberations, in some ways, of the 1973 war. The yeshiva suffers heavy casualties. Because in those years, the yeshivot, the Hesder students were almost all in the tank corps. And the 1973 war was the last great tank war in the 20th century. And so a highly disproportionate number of Hesder students were killed. Those of you who've read the extraordinary book by Rav Chaim Sabato, Tiyum Kavanot, translated into English as Adjusting Sights, is just an amazingly powerful memoir of what that war was and what that war was for a Hesder student. So 8 students of the Gush are killed, which is a very large, a substantial percentage of the student body. Rav Amital is overcome with grief and just hands the yeshiva over to Rav Lichtenstein for a while. Just, says, Rav Lichtenstein, here, Rav Aaron, ani samana maftechot al ha-shulchan, I'm putting my keys on the table, the yeshiva is yours. And just spends months visiting his, because many in the yeshiva are mobilized. Just spends months going from bases to forward deployments to field hospitals to rehabilitation centers to visiting, to making shiva calls, to visiting bereaved families. And it was also during that time that Rav Amital develops extraordinarily close ties with the Israeli officer corps. Eventually he returns to the yeshiva. And he starts giving many sichot, which were published in 1974 in a book called Hama'alot Mima'amakim, The Ascents from the Depths. And they offer his theological interpretation of the Yom Kippur War. Now, as a disciple of Rav Kook, so he had been working and was still working with, first of all, one key element in Rav Kook's teaching. Remember, Rav Kook is very much a divine immanentist, right? God is present, is deeply embedded in the world, in human souls and personalities, and in historical processes. The philosopher Hugo Bergman once pointed out that for Rav Kook, the big theological question isn't to justify the existence of the God. It's not to justify the existence of God. It's how do you justify or explain the existence of the world? Because, God is so all-encompassing that how can anything exist aside from him or apart from him? So Rav Kook is very much an immanentist, and one of Rav Kook's major theological innovations is sort of seeing God at work in history, including in the wholesale revolt against Jewish tradition that is the modern world, including Zionism, secular Zionism. So, and Rav Kook resolves this by seeing this as the unfolding of God's messianic drama, so to speak, as the messianic era nears, so all the contradictions latent in the world have to come to the surface. So as a disciple of Rav Kook, Rav Amital is committed to a messianic and redemptive philosophy of history, which after the Yom Kippur War he still does not abandon, but he gives it a very dark reading, where he says that the... And sort of slicing it thinly, but argues that the times through which he and others are living is not messianic, but redemptive. Right? Not that Otsotot, the Messiah, is about to come and the world's about to become, you know, once and for all a better place, but that these processes bear within them, and even these tragic historical events bear within them the seeds of something better. His book actually becomes a Bible for the settler movement, which, while it started after 1967, really only gets going after the Yom Kippur War. Gush Emunim is created in response to the Yom Kippur War. It's a response to the crisis, the profound moral and spiritual crisis of Israel after 1973, the crisis of leadership, and to the sense of apocalypse that was now in the air. As time goes by, even then, I mean, sort of the leader, the great spiritual leader of Gush Emunim is Rav Kook's son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, with whom, if I may tell it, cordial relations, but weren't necessarily close. Obviously, Rav Amital had relations with Rav Tzvi Yehuda. Indeed, one among the students who studied with Rav Amital in Rehovot was none other than Tzvi Tal, whom Rav Amital sends to Merkaz, where Tzvi Tal then emerges as like this major figure in Merkaz and is now, you know, incredibly important figure in sort of what's called the Chardali, Charidi Leumi, wing of Tzinut HaDatit, his major disciple of Rav Tzvi Yehuda. In any case, Rav Amital, even early on, sort of is very reserved about Rav Tzvi Yehuda's emergence as a Das Torah figure. Right? Because Rav Amital, not surprisingly, is always very leery of rabbinic figures pronouncing on matters of politics and policy through their own ipsy dixit and arguing that their views are to be accepted as the one and only Torah views. Even in the yeshiva, and as is also in a practice that's extraordinary for an Orthodox yeshiva, is that there's a fun practice in the yeshiva that when one of the Rosh Yeshiva gives a sicha, gives a talk on a political issue, and especially on a contentious political issue, then an older student is given equal time to get up and disagree formally in front of the same audience. Right? Which is just an extraordinary kind of gesture, but also indicates then why he was not about to really rally around the emergence of Rav Tzvi Yehuda as a Haredi-style Das Torah figure. And we'll get to this more in a little bit, also had reservations about Rav Tzvi Yehuda's very confident reading of where he thought history was going. Now, after Sadat's visit to Jerusalem, and when we get to the Camp David Accords, Rav Amital gingerly starts suggesting that indeed one might perhaps think of entering in negotiations and willing to contemplate this thing that we call land for peace. Sort of a minority position among rabbis, sort of the only in Israel, the only other rabbi of stature, and frankly, much, you know, a rabbi who was a colossal figure, of course, is Rav Ovadia, who in those years, coming from his own perspective, not from a Tzioni Dati perspective, advocates land for peace on grounds of Pikuach Nefesh. Rav Amital grows further distanced from mainstream religious Zionism after the Lebanon War of 1982, which he, you know, in particular, the massacres at Sabra and Shatila, which, as we recall, right, these phalangists go into phalangist militias go into these Palestinian refugee camps, Sabra and Shatila, and kill an awful lot of people. Admittedly, they're the ones doing the killing, not Tzahal, but Tzahal is letting them happen, enabling them. And Rav Amital, you know, says that when all this comes out, he gives a public statement, says this is just a few days before Yom Kippur, you know, and I'm quaking in judgment as to how God is going to judge us in Yom Kippur, because we know there is no atonement for Chilul Hashem. He's staking out positions. And he and Rav Lichtenstein also call for a commission of inquiry into this. And they really, by now, are kind of like almost like renegades in the religious Zionist camp. Rav Amital, in a way, makes his strongest break with this in 1983 at a meeting of Netivot Shalom, the founding meeting of Netivot Shalom, a fledgling, never entirely successful religious peace movement, where he delivers a very important speech. And he says there are three forms of false messianism at foot in the land of Israel today. That of Gush Emunim, that of Shalom Achshav, and that of Ariel Sharon. And what makes them false messianism is that each one offers a set of, addresses or seeks to address complex problems with very simple answer. Right? So Gush Emunim, simple answer is faith. Shalom Achshav, simple answer is good intentions. And Ariel Sharon, simple answer is force. And of course, he kept saying again and again, there are no simple answers to these complex realities. There's no one size fits all. You need faith, and you need good intentions, and you need the willingness to use force, and all have to be done with wisdom. Eventually, in 1988, he sort of becomes the spiritual sort of figure behind the creation of a party called Meimad. Meimad, the initials for Medina Yehudit, Medina Demokratit. They run in the 1988 Knesset elections. Everything that makes Meimad attractive absolutely dooms it in Israeli electoral politics. The people at the head of it were manifestly devoid of naked political ambition. They weren't really interested in screwing people. There were, you know, let's be moderate, let's be thoughtful, let's be sensible, let's try to see all sides of things, let's try to understand the complexities of things, which of course is an electoral disaster, and they didn't win a single vote, a single seat. I have to add that some years later I was told that actually the time Harvard Hillel had run mock Knesset elections, in which Meimad had won something like 80 seats, you know, so. And then eventually he returns to the yeshiva, emerges into public life once again, actually in 1995, after the murder of Yitzhak Rabin, when Shimon Peres asks him to please serve in his government as minister without portfolio. And he does it to counteract what he saw as the extraordinary Chilul Hashem of Yitzhak Rabin having been murdered by a yarmulke-wearing assassin, and to try and, quixotic as it sounds, bring some message of reconciliation to Israeli society as a whole. I remember at the time when Rav Amital was in the government, coincided with my time in the State Department, and talking to Israeli counterparts in the foreign ministry, they told me that they didn't really know what to do with this rabbi. Because, you know, they'd heard that, like, some rav who had a yeshiva was getting to be minister, you know, was getting a ministerial or, you know, minister without portfolio, was getting a ministerial slot in the government. So they started going through the drill. Okay, he's going to want money for his yeshiva, and he's going to want this, and he's going to want that. And they started looking in the budgets and seeing where they could get money from, because he's going to want this and that. And then the guy shows up, and he doesn't want anything. These, like, Chiloni diplomats. They couldn't believe it. A rabbi gets handed a ministerial slot and he doesn't want anything? The guy told me, like, we'd never seen such a thing. Right.
In the yeshiva, Rav Amital, sees the fun saw throughout, and so then his main work then, and for the remaining years, of course, is in the yeshiva. So in the yeshiva, Rav Amital viewed the foremost task of a Rosh Yeshiva as, of course, delivering in-depth lectures on Talmud and Halakha. His Talmudic methodology sort of synthesized, bearing in lines of things I've been saying, of kind of Lithuanian style analysis of the traditional lumdus, drawing on his great bikiyut. He made it clear all the time that he was there to challenge and be challenged,
And as part of his educational philosophy, he kept saying, Ani lo rotze amitalim ktanim. I'm not trying to create little amitals. He invited discussion and dissent and independent thought. He also was always encouraging students to think for themselves and to encourage their own moral intuitions. I mean, I have many stories. I'm sure a number of you here have stories. It's two stories I like to tell. One is an old story, another is from the Shiva. He told me one point, you know, in yeshiva, there's always like guys, serious yeshiva students, people gravitate or sort of to different areas or create their own specialties, right? So in yeshiva, you'll have like the guy who really knows Hilchot Shabbat inside out, you know, and you'll have the guy who really knows Eruvin inside out. And you'll have the guy who's like the Tanakh guy. And you'll have the guy who's the Rambam guy or the Machshava guy. And you'll have, you know, and so on. So there was one guy in yeshiva who his thing was like Chelek Aleph of Shulchan Aruch Aruch Chaim. So he was like a real, you know, he'd made it his business somehow. He'll chod brachot, he'll chod tefillah, birkot hanenin, you know, that kind of stuff. He really knew. And one time he came to Rav Amital with like some very involved question. You started to eat, you didn't start to eat, you thought you didn't know that you weren't going to start to eat. You know, you started to make the bracha, the food was half in your mouth when you made the first part of the bracha, then half out of your mouth when you made the second part of the bracha. You know, one of those things. And Rav Amital said to him, "Mulai tishal tipam shela chashuva." Right? Maybe you'll ask me an important question sometimes. And the guy said, "Harav, like what could be more important than this? I mean, the bracha of Atala, you know, it's nisderai. So what? Ma yoter chashuv mize?" I mean, that's a tikkun agunot. That's something worth spending your time on. Now he's not saying go do bracha of Atala, right? He's not saying go do bracha of Atala. Adrava, Rav Amital is a great believer in kviyut, in. I mean, one of the things that's interesting with him is that, on the one hand, a deep spiritual personality resonates a lot to Hasidut and to Kabbalah and all these things, and yet it's very four square and traditional halakha. Something that he loves to quote, you know, there's a thing we always love to quote the Ma'amar Chazal, what's called V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, zeh klal gadol b'Torah. And you remember in the Gemara, there's a machloket, what's the klal gadol b'Torah? Is it v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha or zeh sefer toldot ha'adam? Right, you know, two very stirring, rousing psukim. There's another version of that machloket, which appears in only one place. It's much later. It appears in the introduction to Ein Yaakov. A version of this machloket appears in the sources brought in Ein Yaakov, and Rav Amital loves to quote it. Because there are two, there's the machloket, what's the klal gadol b'Torah? And one view is v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, love thy neighbors thyself, and the other is Zet Sefer Todot Adam. This Sefer Todot Adam, the book is. This is the story of humanity. You know, the Torah, and then the third sheet is, you know, what's called Gadol Torah. Et Akeves Ha'achad Taseh BeBoker, Et Akeves Ha'Sheni Taseh Bin Harbayim. Right, sort of, you know, morning sacrifice, evening sacrifice, on time, the way you're supposed to do them, etc. Like that's that you need to balance that. These great moments of religious exaltation and sweeping moral vision have to be anchored in like a very solid commitment to daily practice. Another story that I love to tell is one that I actually heard at the Shiva from a fellow I didn't know before, who it seems had come to the yeshiva after learning for a number of places somewhere else, I forget where, but he came to the yeshiva. He was already Shana Zion or Shana Chet, something like that. So he was already, you know, in his mid-20s. And this guy had the minhag of, like, putting on tefillin at mincha. And some of the gabayim came to him and said, Shema, you know, we don't do this here. You know, this is, you know. So he said, no, I'll go ask the Rosh Yeshiva. So we went and asked Rav Amital and said, what should I, you know? Rav Amital said to him, Shema, this business putting on tefillin at mincha, I never saw Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer do this. But you never saw Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. Think about it. Decide what you want to do. And do it. Right? He was very critical of this phenomenon of shilas and tshuvas by cell phones and by the internet. Why? Because he says, it reflects people not being able to think for themselves. And that was something that he shared with Rav Lichtenstein. Very rare something, and sometimes I think it's as rare among academics as among Rosh Yeshiva. This commitment to teach their student, a belief that it's the job of the Rosh Yeshiva to teach the students to think for themselves. Now, turning to Rav Amital's educational philosophy and larger religious ideas, I'd say two fundamental principles in his approach are sort of humanity and a striving for truth and authenticity. In a sense, they're two sides of the same coin. So in elaborating the principles of his religious educational outlook in his book that was translated, Havaretz Natan Levnei Adam, which was translated in English inexplicably as Jewish Values in a Changing World, Rav Amital points, he had conversations as the years went by with the Ramim about, you know, again, they wanted to hear from him, like, how would you articulate your educational philosophy? And so he wrote it down. It's a slim book, but well worth reading. He points to four dimensions of what he means by enoshiyut, humanity. One, quote, the worship of God in whatever form cannot wipe out simple human feeling. Right? As an example, he cites the obligation of a Kohen to defile himself and mourn despite his calling to serve in the temple. Right? Even Aharon receives Moshe's approval when he's mourning for his sons. You can't eradicate fundamental human intuitions. Two, enoshiyut, humanity, entails the recognition of fundamental human traits, including human weakness and frailty. This applies to great individuals and even canonical figures. Rav Amital loves to point out that the Torah presents the Avot in all their weaknesses, Moshe Rabbeinu in all his weaknesses. A further dimension of this humanity is accepting the inevitability of prosaic motivations in our ethical and religious lives, which also means that we cannot expect asceticism. You can't expect people to live like ascetics. And this in turn relates to another element in Rav Amital's life and teaching, which is great respect for what he called Yehudim Pshutim, simple Jews. For years and years, he used to attend the daily Mishnah class in his neighborhood in Givat Mordechai. And people had different interpretations. Why did he do this? Some people thought it's because he wanted to show that it's very important to learn Mishnah. You know, some people said it's because he wanted to show kavod to the Rav of the Shechuna and this and that. But often people said, no, just because he liked to sit and learn Mishnah with Pashadiyin. I remember towards the end of his life, once we were talking with a bunch of us there, and he was talking about Yehudim Pshutim. And he said, you know, I never liked this Ashkenazi Shvitzerai. Denigrating Pasha the Yidden. And one of the guys there talking in the neo-Hasidic vein that, you know, types like us talk in all the time, said, Ken, you know, Zelo Pashut, Lihot Yehudi Pashut. You know, it's not simple to be a simple Jew. And Rav Amital said, that's also Shvitzerai. And a final expression is the wonderful assertion in the piyut of Yom Kippur, Asheri Matcha, that, the, you know, Ve'e Matcha Lehem, you know, that God, he always used to love quoting the word of the Kotzker Rebbe, Va'anshei Kodesh Tiyun Li, that God is saying essentially where the Kotzker said, why does God say, Anshei Kodesh Tiyun Li? Because I have enough angels. Angels I have all over the place. You know, I can't get away from them. I want people. I want flesh and blood human beings. Now, this set of ideas is connected to another in the same volume, that of what he calls tiviyut, naturalness in the life of mitzvot. Those many of you know, Rav Amital's favorite nigun was v'tahir livenu lo avdecha be'emet. Which he said, a person's performance of mitzvot, and I'm quoting, should correspond to his internal state of loving God, fearing God, and seeking God's closeness with no disproportion between the quantity of his actions and internal values, unquote. So this acceptance of human frailty doesn't mean that you suffice with low levels of spiritual achievement, but you should never deceive yourself about your own level and make sure that your actions, and especially your chumrot, are in accordance with who you really are. Now, throughout Rav Amital's teachings, one finds fundamentally positive outlooks on the world and on people as they are. And this then is of a piece with his notion of Enoshiyut as the affirmation of natural morality. Right? It's a very well-known passage in the writings of Rav Kook. Right? You know, Asur li Yirat Shamayim litchorera Musar TV, that is, piety should not displace man's natural morality, for such piety is impure. The sign of pure piety is when natural morality, implanted in man's naturally just nature, ascends at piety's direction to greater heights than would otherwise have attained. So that Torah is not meant to displace or supplant our intuitive moral senses, but rather to refine them, expand their horizons, and build on them. Which also means that our ethical behavior should be motivated, should be the product of genuine moral education, and that we don't act kindly to other people because we're robots, but because we have cultivated in ourselves developed our own natural intuitions that enable us to identify with the sufferings of other human beings. In other words, Enoshiyut, humanity, is conceptualized and put into practice by Rav Amital, perhaps cuts deeper and reaches farther than good counsel and pedagogy. It is, and at this point we're starting, just in the interest of full disclosure, this is already me interpreting Rav Amital. So I just want to be very clear about that. So I'm not, But at any rate, this affirmation of Enoshiyut then is perhaps more than good counsel and pedagogy. It's a theological assertion about God's goodness, reflected in the goodness of creation, above all in human beings and their moral senses. This affirmation of Enoshiyut is, in other words, an affirmation of faith. And then perhaps this affirmation of faith is the closest one can come to a post-Holocaust theology, as we start moving to the centrality of the Holocaust in Rav Amital's thought. Not post-Holocaust theodicy, right? We can understand why God did this and so on. But rather as a way of asserting the faith that remains after the Holocaust, that in response to the Holocaust, we have to heighten our sense of natural morality, which is to heighten our sense of the moral sense that God planted within us. In other words, to go on believing in God is to believe in the fundamental goodness of creation, irrational or irrational as that may be, which is to say to believe in Enoshiyut, to believe in humanity. And yet, Rav Amital's belief in humanity was not that of secular humanism. Secular humanism, to his mind, attempts to enshrine human dignity without recourse to God. And he thinks that this attempt has run aground entirely and desperately in the Holocaust. At the same time, Rav Amital resolutely opposed any attempt to explain the Holocaust by way of one theological formula or another, be that of Satmar or of Rav Tzvi Yehuda. Right? Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook famously claimed that the Holocaust, as he put it, was God's radical surgery in order to get the Jewish people out of exile once and for all, which then meant that Eretz Yisrael was more important than one could possibly imagine. Right? We could talk more about Rav Tzvi Yehuda and the Holocaust later. One thing I would just say now is that as much as I profoundly, disagree with this, I see Rav Tzvi Yehuda as sort of almost tragically driven to this view in part of like a human drama of, his father dies in 1935 and leaves him to face the Holocaust by himself. And in 1934, Rav Kook gave a drasha saying that, talking about the persecutions in Germany and saying that perhaps this is God's way of getting the Jewish people out of exile. But that's 1934, a long time before other things happened. But this is what Rav Tzvi Yehuda had to go on. At any rate, Rav Amital forthrightly rejects that. Ravamital says that the Holocaust placed an eternal question mark over any claims to read God's mind. As Ravamital famously said, you can see it on YouTube, where he said there's absolutely nothing that can justify the murder of hundreds of thousands of children. Absolutely nothing. Not Yemot HaMashiach, not the state of Israel, not the entire Jewish people doing tshuva. So yet, as I said, for Avamital, the Holocaust places an eternal question mark over any claim that one can read God's mind. Yet this epistemological humility, this religious submission before the unknowable, accompanied with acceptance of God's ethical charge and spiritual demands on us, is precisely that which can give us the strength and guidance to go on living after the Holocaust. By contrast, as he saw it, secular humanism, lacking a foundation, cannot endure, its good intentions notwithstanding. Again, because for Ravamital, the Jewish people, also in terms of, as he said in some interviews in the 1980s, you know, what's my Seder Adifuyot? For the Jewish people, Torah, Eretz Yisrael, because the first thing is just to survive, to preserve the sheer physical survival of people before we move on to other things. Ravamital's ethics was not an abstract ethical theory that we then impose on the world, but emerges from his fundamental humanity, intuition, and existential stance. Now, interestingly, as a question of how one interprets Rav Kook, because there's a large question, whereas Rav Kook's own corpus is vast and sprawling and pulls in multiple directions. I quoted a few minutes Rav Kook's comment about how piety cannot displace natural morality. Needless to say, there's a gajillion, for a million and one quotations about morals and ethics and universal ethics in Rav Kook, there's a gajillion and one about the significance of Eretz Yisrael or about the Jewish people and Jewish people and so on. So in a sense, Ravamital's deep machloket for Tzvi Yehuda is what is the hermeneutic principle by which you interpret this corpus of thought, which for religious Zionists is a canonical corpus. And for Tzvi Yehuda, the hermeneutical key is Eretz Yisrael. In the mid-1980s, at a conference in 1985, Ravamital, and I think it's the product of his reflection, says that the hermeneutical key is ethics. And indeed, the state of Israel, and this is an amazing thing for a Holocaust survivor to say, the state of Israel exists in order to further the Jewish people's ethical mission to humanity. Now I talked about Ravamital emphasizing individualism in the study of God, and yet this isn't solipsistic, and it's anchored in deep commitments, because as I said, Ravamital early on realizes that the Tzioni Dati Yeshivot need elements of Hasidic teaching. And then, as a friend of mine, my friend Dr. Ari Ackerman put it, Ravamital was ahead of his time in realizing that there needed to be some neo-Hasidic flavor in the yeshivot in order to inject some spirituality. And then he was ahead of his time in seeing that it was perhaps going too far and needed to be pulled back. And in sort of the last dozen years, the last 10, 15 years, on the one hand, Ravamital had, introduced currents of dveikut, joyous worship, fraternity into religious Zionist education. And also it's worth noting that when he did with it was always removed from mysticism, magic, and personality cult, and always anchored in dialogic frameworks of people's relationship to one another and to God. Now, but on the other hand, and so he became a critic of other trends that have been emerging in religious Zionism over the years, that celebrate individualism in a way that he found to be kind of solipsistic and an obsession with personal authenticity at the cost of assuming responsibility. So, then throughout you see in getting to the to the reminding us of the title of this lecture, throughout his life, Rav Amital, this was faith in complexity. Throughout his life, Rav Amital is living this very extraordinary attempt to, on the one hand, hold fast to certain very basic truths and commitments, certain moral intuitions, certain fundamental commitments to Torah and mitzvot. A lot of the issues that bedevil modern Jewish theology, does God exist, does God not exist, the truth of revelation at Mount Sinai, etc., they simply didn't interest him. In some ways, the simplicity, the religious simplicity of his Hungarian childhood never left him. There is throughout this attempt to, it's almost like square the circle of simplicity and complexity, of being willing to recognize that life is complex and there are no simple answers. As part of his educational philosophy was to say over and over, ein patentin, there's no gimmicks, there's no easy fixes, there's no substitute for hard work and for thinking things through and for recognizing that things are complicated. While at the same time doing so, while trying to cultivate both some very basic moral intuitions and fundamental and unshakable commitments to Torah and mitzvot. And it's not an easy thing to do. It's manifest also in his attitude towards the Holocaust. Rav Amital would say at times, you know, I have no doubt that God spoke in the Holocaust. I just have no idea what he was trying to say. And yet he was willing to go on living in a place, in an existential place of doubt and uncertainty without fetishizing doubt and uncertainty, the way so many of us do. How did Rav Amital leave the yeshiva? Well, once again, he and Rav Lichtenstein decided that the terrible succession struggles that racked yeshivot were not things they wanted to do. In many ways, you know, the cooperation between the two of them was the deepest educational lesson that the yeshiva imparted. And so they decided to appoint search committees that would pick their own successors and that they would leave, you know. And a number of years ago, Rav Amital simply announced he was leaving. There would be successors. They would step up too. Again, which is just to the end, this extraordinary independence, integrity. Also, as the years went by, Rav Amital talked about the Holocaust more and more and more. At times, towards in the last year or two of his life, it really seemed, the image I often had in my mind is as though some kind of mist was lifting. That all the extraordinary Israeli story, history that he had lived in and done much to create was somehow lifting like so much mist, and what was left was the Holocaust in very stark relief. He became more and more pessimistic about the optimistic Cookean reading of history. And yet to the end, still maintained that, you know, that the state of Israel's creation was a miraculous and wondrous thing, that had to be deeply appreciated and that its life had to be engaged with. And his educational philosophy was consistent to the end. The very last conversation I had with him, which was just a couple of weeks before he died, since last year, so he couldn't leave the house much, so people used to gather in his home to daven. The time I was there, the family asked me to speak to him, you know, a bit, because usually I didn't want to bother him. And so I was talking to him, and I asked him whenever over the years, my sort of little minhag when meeting him, when getting together with him, would be to ask, Al Maharav Choshev Bizman HaCharon. What is the rabbi been thinking about lately? And so once again, I asked him that. I asked, Al Maharav Choshev Bizman HaCharon. And he said, Yigiazman Latzirim Lachshov Machshavot. It's time for the young people to think. So it was a 45-minute walk back to our apartment from his on that Shabbos morning. And as I was walking, I was just kind of reeling the whole time. I was dizzy the whole time. Because I understood that he was saying goodbye. And how is he saying goodbye? To the end. Saying, go! Think! Think for yourself. I don't know if we will see his like again. But Rav Amital was the person who said you have to have faith. So I have faith that perhaps one day we will. Right. Thank you very much. Whatever you want.
Okay. We'll leave it on that note. Just, three things. Okay, Yesher Koach for Avir Mimzak, of course, was not a student in Gush. And I maybe met Rav Amital sort of in the distance. I don't know if I ever met him, personally heard him speak once or twice when I visited the yeshiva, but thank you very much.